Word. Hey, everybody. I'm Nan, and welcome to... Wait, okay, hold on. Oh, my gosh, I messed up the intro.
That's okay. Keep
welcome
going.
To Melrose. Welcome to Melrose Sheltering in Place. I'm Nan.
And I'm Christopher, and I hope you're comfortable recording today because Audacity was all over the news the last couple of weeks. Did you see any of that?
Oh, no, I missed it. Is it like... recording us secretly and sending our data somewhere? What's happening?
Well, that's what people think. So do you remember a few years ago, this was a really big thing where people started trying to read and understand terms of service and they would freak out about them.
Right.
And it's like, you're just don't understand. Like, I remember people specifically were talking about Snapchat. They're like, why does Snapchat need to know my location? And it's like, well, because Snapchat has a lot of location-based services like filters that, you know, say where you are. Like when you're in the city of Mukilteo, there are specific Mukilteo ones, right? So, you know, all these people like who just shouldn't even bother reading the terms of service because their mind's gonna go places. But anyway, that happened to Audacity, and everybody was like, "It's spyware! It's spyware!"
Oh my God.
And then of course, like 5 days later, with like 100th the amount of attention, you start seeing a few links here and there. Audacity is not spyware.
Well, I mean, and this is the thing too. Like, I believe in like worrying about your privacy. That said, I want to just put this out there for everybody. If you are on the internet, your data, it's out there. It's being shared. People have it. You know, like, I don't know what to tell people. Like, if you don't like that, I mean, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, that's kind of it's just how it works, right? Like, we don't pay for Facebook. Facebook uses data about us to sell us ads. They've had a lot of really dumb missteps in terms of what they should be doing with that data, but everybody knows about them. Like, you could actually do a lot better paying more attention to the real things that have happened on these sites rather than misunderstanding end user license agreements constantly, right?
Also, like, the reason they share terms of service with you is so that you can decide whether or not you want to interface with that thing. I don't have Facebook.
Right.
Right? Like, that is actually an option. You cannot have Facebook. And it mostly will not impact your life. I promise. It mostly has not impacted mine. Like, I'm sure there's like a handful here and there of like parties I've missed or whatever. But like, I mean, you know, in my experience, the people who really want me at their parties, like, text me or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I hear all kinds of excuses for why people have to have Facebook. But the truth is, hardly anybody looks at it anymore. You can just quit. And that's why the terms of service are there. It's like, if you don't like the terms of service, don't use the thing.
Right. And isn't it funny on Facebook specifically when people think that they can like get around terms of service by posting statements like, I do not give permission.
You know, oh, I've never seen that.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. People are so stupid.
That's why I don't understand how anyone can work for Snopes, because so much of your day at Snopes is spent researching all these dumb things, like people, you know, thinking that they can reset their algorithm and not see the same 26 people over and over again. Like, no, you just need to go to the most recent view. Like, anyway.
Man. And here, like, I just want to be very clear. I think Facebook is the devil. I think corporations are evil. But at the same time, you do have some option about whether or not to engage with these things.
Right. Yeah.
And if you tell yourself you don't, you're a little bit lying to yourself. Like, I know people who will say they need to promote things. And to that I say, okay, that's a decent argument for why you have to interface with Facebook, but that's not most people.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So and again, I think that Facebook as a promotional tool has kind of outlived its usefulness anyway. Most people are not really like getting the information they need when they need it. Like, I'm sure we've all had that experience of like the event shows up on my feed the day after it happened, right? Like, I don't know. It's not the most useful tool in the world. in my experience.
Yeah. And I don't know. Well, it's almost like if you're using it for events, like you have to treat it just like Evite used to be, like, and you almost have to follow up with people outside of it. Just like, hey, did you see that? Because you're right.
This is the thing is like, so I work in fundraising, and I think part of the problem here is always that people are looking for the easier, simpler, faster magic bullet to solve all their like work problems. And, you know, we see it in fundraising where people want to be able to just put up a link and be like, give to my thing, and the donations will roll right in. No. And that just doesn't happen. Like, the research has shown, like, social media is not necessarily super useful for fundraising. You know what is useful for fundraising? When I follow up with people one-on-one in a DM and say, are you going to give me your money or not? Like, or when I talk to people, you know, like, you still, the rules of getting people to take action on a thing are pretty much exactly the same as they've always been. And very few people are going to take action purely on a link crossing their eyeballs on a feed.
Yeah. Cause it's low impact.
No magic bullet.
Yeah.
So if you want people to know about your shit, care about your shit, engage with your shit, you have to do a lot of work. And that's just the way it is. That's how humans are.
I will say I am grateful for Facebook this week because so here's one thing that I hate that people do on Facebook when they're looking for work, that they just post, I need a job, and they don't say what they do. You know, they don't say what they just finished doing, yada, yada. So I decided to do the opposite. I did a big, long post giving a really good description of my last job that I just finished. And I said, I'm doing this so that people who know me, who might have opportunities where they work, will know whether I might be a good fit for them. And sure enough, somebody that I know from college, who I worked with in college, is working very hard to get me an interview for a technical writing job that would, you know, not be that exciting to me, but the pay would be.
I mean, that sounds great. Yeah. And also, yeah, doing exciting things for work is dumb as hell.
Yeah. Well, I was, one thing that excited me about my last job was that it came with a lot of self-managed time.
that is the real deal. Let me tell you, that is almost more than money. That is the thing that I prize more than anything, is like having a lot of control over my schedule and working not in an office, so that when I have pockets of time, I can do literally anything.
Yeah. Right now, my goal, the reason I'm taking this potential opportunity very seriously, is for the good pay, because I've been seeing a lot of job listings for jobs that I would like to do. That would be a massive pay cut. And one of my goals is retirement. And so I figure maybe now is the time to just be super serious for a couple of years. And then maybe that could help build up the IRA a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, and you know, it could, it's a big company too. So it could also just lead to slightly more interesting opportunities, but anyway.
Yeah, you never know what'll happen once you get in there and you know, wiggle around.
Yeah, so may as well jump from one evil corporation to another.
I mean, but we all gotta have jobs.
Exactly.
Absolutely nobody can have, there's no such thing, honestly, as a job that's not complicit in the system.
Exactly.
Ask me how I know. Don't ask me how I know. But anyway, cool. Well, do we want to talk about episodes?
Yeah. So we are starting today with season 3, excuse me, episode 13, which is called Just Say No. That another strange, strange title. I would have called it Just Say Joe. Anyway.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Okay. So the show opens up at the beach house with Michael very curious about why a baby and a nurse suddenly live there. Because, you know, he didn't know anything about Kimberly's diabolical plot. Jane calls to let Michael know that Chris made off with all the money. You might remember it was $500,000. And there's nothing the police can do since she opened a joint account with him.
I find it hard to believe that she has no legal recourse.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not in this moment. Like, maybe the actual law enforcement officers can't do anything, because what police do is very different than, like, what... But she could sue him, I'm sure.
Yeah. It might be that she needs to talk to a lawyer more than a cop, but...
Right, yeah. Anyway.
Although you would think that maybe an investigator could be helping with this. I don't know. But
yeah, how have we not had a single private investigator on this show yet?
Michael leaves in a convertible, the official car type of Melrose Place now. And Joe, who was hiding in a car across the street, knocks on the door. Kimberly somehow anticipated this and was waiting outside for Joe for some reason. And she laughs at her and she kicks her off the property. So in the limo on the way to Vegas, you know, where Chris has snatched Sydney and absconded with her, Sydney tells Chris that she's going to the police as soon as they arrive. She's very unhappy about being kidnapped, but he tries to make it better with a necklace. They arrive at Caesar's Palace, and Chris tells her that she could leave at any time, but he doesn't think that she will. He explains that Jane doesn't raise his flag the way that she does. That's talk for making a boner. And he offers to buy her a dress, which calms her down for a moment. They pick up a shiny black one that costs more than her last car, which, you know, could be $500. I don't know.
I mean, really. That dress did not look that fucking expensive.
Then they head to the casino to gamble. Michael waits at Jane's door for her to come home. They start to fight, but then Jake arrives and asks if Jane has heard from Sydney. Michael apologizes for assuming she was in cahoots with Chris when it's now obvious that Sydney is. Meanwhile, Sydney enjoys a massage with cocktails and chocolate-covered strawberries in the suite. Chris finally makes it clear to Sydney that he really, really wants to bone. And by the way, there's a room service waiter in this scene who is played by Robert Gant, who was in Queer as Folk, the US version, and 13 Reasons Why, which is a show that I enjoyed and Nan does not plan to watch.
I will never watch that show. Also, we figured out before this episode, before we started recording, that he was also in Caroline in the City.
Right. And that's a show we can agree on for sure. High quality.
For sure.
Joe heads to the hospital to try to get help with the baby situation. But the guy she talks to says that he can't even get started since Joe doesn't know the name of the other woman involved in the stillborn switcheroo.
This whole exchange was so weird. Like, she just storms in, and the guy that works for the hospital is, like, falling all over himself to, like, almost like he kind of believes her, which I just, we know that she's right, but do you think anybody in the real world would just believe this person that walked in and was like, they stole my baby?
Well,
I mean, it's not like he totally believes her, but do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like he's like giving her the time of day in a way and like falling all over himself. And I don't know. It was just very odd.
Well,
it was a very odd scene.
And another problem is if he does believe her, he's believing that she participated in a conspiracy to steal her own baby away from its legal guardians. So he probably shouldn't help even if he does believe her. He should probably be calling the police on her.
But then I guess he referred her to a psych or recommended that she see a psychiatrist. So I guess he doesn't really believe her,
yeah.
But it's just very, it was very odd.
Yeah, he does that and that pisses her off and she storms out of there just yelling. Speaking of people storming, Chris storms into the suite where Sydney's ready with some expensive Las Vegas entertainment options. But Chris has already lost most of Jane's money, $500,000, and has gone past his limit at the casino. He tries to kiss Sydney, who then tries to walk out when he explains that he stole from Jane and Michael. He hits her when she won't take off that necklace, and instead of walking out the front door, Sydney locks herself in the bathroom right next to it instead. You know, this is the classic Sydney move. She always hides in a locked room instead of running away. She calls Jake from the bathroom phone for help. Instead of the police or even hotel security, right? Like, hotel security could be there in 4 minutes. The police could be there in 20. But she's going to call Jake, who's in Los Angeles. So anyway, he calls Jane, and Jake and Jane make plans to meet at the airport. Whew. Jake finds Sydney in the suites, where she's still hanging around, even though Chris could come back anytime. Jake is incredulous because he was expecting to find her in distress, but she's all jeweled up and she has room service. Michael and Jane find Chris in the casino and demand their money, but all he has left is the magical number, $5,000. Jane attacks him, but Michael pulls her off and tries to attack him himself. But Chris makes quick work of him, slamming him face first into the padded edge of the dice table, or whatever you call that dice game table.
Oh, craps.
Craps table. Thank you. Okay, so Chris is gone, and Sydney gets no pity at all from Michael and Jane about the kidnapping. Jane and Michael decide to hang around in Vegas for a while Sydney and Jake go to the airport. Sydney apologizes for what happened, but says that she just wishes Jane would have listened to her about Chris. However, Jake is not happy with Sydney either.
When she was, like, taking his hand to, like, lead him out of the hotel room, and he sort of seemed like he was trying to pull it away, like, in this really fed-up manner, his acting in this episode was really funny.
And I gotta say kudos to, Jake for kind of standing up for himself, because it would have been really easy to just, you know, have sex with her instead, you know, a little bit of, grudge fucking or something. So Michael and Jane take that $5,000 worth of chips to a roulette table, and they bet it all on black, and they lose. And they head back to the suite to raid the bar. And over drinks, Michael tells Jane that he's unhappy with the baby situation. Which is funny, because he told Kimberly that if she could make a baby happen, they could have a baby. And then...
Yeah, but you know Michael. He just said that to get her off his case.
Right.
Thinking that she wouldn't be able to do it.
In like 5 days.
Yeah. I mean... In his defense, too, not to, I don't ever want to too heavily defend Michael, but, you know, the only way she was able to make this happen was by doing this completely bananas scheme of, like, stealing a baby and falsifying records and all this nonsense.
Hey, she's a go-getter. What can we say? Very resourceful. In a twist that shocks nobody, Michael and Jane laugh over these drinks, and then they kiss, and then they bone. A little bit of a drunken Vegas backslide. Jane just wanted to see what it feels like to be the other woman for once.
Oh my god.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just said, oh my god.
So the next morning, Jane thanks Michael for the shtup. And she leaves. Kind of a what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas kind of thing. He wants more, but Jane says, nope, it's a one-night stand, and it's not the new beginning that he wants. Joe arrives at the beach house ready for a fight, but Kimberly says that she's already called the police, and Joe throws a chair through the sliding glass door, pushes Kimberly aside, and picks up the baby. And just then, the police burst in with guns drawn. They take the baby from Joe, and they arrest her. That's always happening, Joe getting arrested. It's like her thing. Over in everybody else's world, Bruce stops Allison in the hall at D&D, and he tells her that he fired Amanda. Dun-dun. She'll be a part of the new team that he's forming. So she goes to Amanda's office to offer her condolences, which sets Amanda off.
Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Like, this guy just told you that he's going to replace her basically with you. And I don't know, like, even if you were sincere and wanted to be supportive to your friend, would you not be like, I don't know, maybe my friend won't really doesn't want to hear it from me right now. I don't know.
Well,
just a thought.
And also, they live together. They're going to run into each other like that evening. you may as well save that first meetup for when it's like inevitable and not so fresh. I don't know. Yeah. Allison's got some bad judgment here. So Amanda makes a reference to the kid that Allison hit with her car and then leaves. And it just occurred to me that it was kind of late at night when Allison hit that kid with her car. What was that kid even doing out there?
I don't know. Like, that's a good question.
Why aren't you in school? Anyway, Allison heads back to Bruce's office to let him know that she's there for him. And that he would actually be more familiar with her accomplishments if Amanda didn't always take credit for everything. Just then, Bruce gets a call from his attorney, and he learns that a group of donors bought a large portion of stock, and he's no longer the majority shareholder. At the board meeting the next morning, a representative from that doctor's group reveals that they have someone other than Billy and Allison in mind for agency operations. And it's just funny to me how quickly those two became so senior. But anyway, Peter walks in with Amanda and reveals that he's the one who put together the consortium. Amanda is now president of the agency, effective immediately, and she promotes Billy to VP of accounts, even though he's a copywriter. And says like he should be the creative director, but anyway,
right, yeah.
And says that they'll deal with Allison later. She pulls Billy aside and tells him that he has to fire Allison and that he has 24 hours to do it. So Susan and Billy celebrate his promotion, but he's clearly unhappy about the situation with Allison. Susan reminds him that they promised not to talk about Allison, and in a surprising moment of understanding, he says that he can't help it because it's his fault that she's drinking, which, way to go, you fell for her manipulation. It's nobody's fault but Allison's.
Right.
Meanwhile, Allison stumbles home and sees them making out through their window because they always have to stand by the window and make a little show of it just in case anybody's walking by. So Allison storms up the stairs and confronts them about their little candle table that they have set up for a romantic dinner and everything else that's been going on. Billy tries to see Allison out, but she throws him off her arm and she trashes the candle table.
I always love a good table trashing.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And if there are any new listeners by any chance, when we talk about candle tables, that's our term of endearment for a romantic table set up with candles. Which happens surprisingly frequently. I mean, I don't know, Nan, if you have ever set up a candle table.
I mean, sure, once or twice, but it definitely has never been like a super regular occurrence in my life.
Yeah, it's definitely a Melrose Place thing, even if the food that's going to be on the candle table is like, tuna casserole because Billy's sad. Let's see, Amanda goes to her office in the morning and she finds that Bruce has hung himself in her office.
God, when she walked in and he was hanging there and he had that note pinned to him that was like, congratulations,
yeah,
on your new promotion. I was like, that was one of the moments where, because I texted you and I was like, you know that montage in the Melrose Place made for TV movie where like it was the writers in the writer's room,
yeah,
just like getting crazier and crazier? I was like, this feels like part of that.
For sure.
Situation. Like, it was just so over the top.
And did you notice how loose the noose was? Like,
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how he didn't just fall right out of it. Like, Let's see. Okay. Allison tells Amanda that she's the reason he killed himself. And Amanda tells Billy that if she doesn't fire Allison by the end of the day, he's fired too. So Billy confronts Allison about what happened the night before, and she admits she doesn't even remember it. Billy goes to Matt for advice, and he suggests a treatment program for Allison. If she's actively seeking treatment, she can't be fired. It's the law. I wonder if that's even true.
It might be true. Yeah. I can see. I mean, it might not be. It might not be statute, but it might be something you can sue over. Okay. But it would depend on the state. Because if you're in an at-will employment state, there's very little that you can actually sue over.
Yeah.
But this is California, so
they have generous laws there, especially for things like divorce and who knows, maybe employment too. So Billy goes to Matt for advice. Oh, sorry, I just read that. Allison comes home to an intervention from Matt, Susan, Billy, and Dr. Katz from the Twin Oaks Rehab Center. And I love them naming somebody Dr. Katz because the cartoon Dr. Katz was one of the greatest shows of all time.
Totally.
She just wants to go to AA, but Matt says there's a 28-day program for her at Twin Oaks. So she agrees to go, and they haven't even told her that it'll save her job yet. Allison and Billy head to rehab in Matt's Geo Tracker. And she says that she needs the restroom when they stop for gas, but she sneaks away instead because when you're taking somebody to a rehab, you're definitely going to let them sneak off by themselves. Like, that's a real rookie move, guys. She finds a bar and she thinks about going inside, but she sits on a bench for a quick existential crisis instead. Allison somehow arrives at Twin Oaks. We have no idea how she got there. And she checks herself in. And that's the episode.
Dun, dun, dun. So now we're on episode 14, Sex, Drugs, and Rockin' the Cradle.
Oh, yeah.
These titles. Okay, so Joe meets with her attorney and comes clean about the scam she tried to pull with Kimberly. He said he had a great case for an appeal, but she's ruined everything, and his only choice is to pretend they never had this conversation. Michael calls Jane because he can't stop thinking about her. But for her, the sex was just, something to do. She hangs up on him. Oh, how the tables have turned on Michael. Sydney goes to Jake's to clear the air about Vegas. He says he believes her, but that they handle things differently. She says she never slept with Chris in Vegas, but Jake notices how specific that is and gets her to confess about the mob guy getting her to sleep with him before. Roses from Michael arrive for Jane. Oh, I love this part. at her studio, and she sends them to the beach house instead. She tells the delivery guy, like, oh, I think these were supposed to go here.
That was amazing.
So Kimberly reads the card from Michael to Jane and smashes the bouquet against the wall, making Michael Jr. cry in his bassinet. Man, the baby cried through this like whole episode. It was super annoying.
Yeah.
The next morning, she shakes Michael awake and throws the card at him, but he says he's just messing with Jane. Like, oh my God. The man just like always has some like lie at the ready. But like, what would even be the purpose of that? I don't, it's just like to send Jane flowers saying, I still love you, to mess with her.
Yeah.
The nurse says Michael Jr. is having trouble breathing and Michael thinks they should go to the hospital, but Kimberly says she'll take care of it with a prescription. And I really thought that was foreshadowing that they were going to kill the baby accidentally. I have to say, like, at some point during the next episode, I was like, wow, you know, we really underestimated this baby arc. Because, like, We both just thought they were going to have a miscarriage, some situation to just get rid of the baby super quickly. And they are really milking this baby storyline.
Yeah.
For everything it is worth.
We may as well call this show Baby Place at this point. God.
So later, Michael Jr. has a fever and Michael wants to go to the ER, but Kimberly says they can't. And tells Michael she bought him on the black market. He insists that they go anyway. Joe finds Michael at the hospital in the morning and asks about her baby. And Michael thinks she's just in shock and believes Kimberly. Joe finally asks for a blood test. Michael eventually calls Joe to let her know she was right about the baby being hers. But that her options now are to surrender Michael Jr. to the Carters or let Michael and Kimberly raise him.
Good point.
I was so confused by this response because I was like, Michael didn't want to adopt a baby.
Oh, yeah.
He was mad that Kimberly got this baby. But then the minute he has the opportunity to, like, leverage this power over Joe, he immediately takes it and is like, you know.
Yeah.
Is he just, like, compulsive? Is he just, like, what do you think? I cannot figure out his motivation, like, 90% of the time. Like, when he was defending Kimberly to Joe before the blood test, it was like, I believe my wife. I'm like, you don't even seem to like her. Like, I just cannot figure out what this person's deal is.
It's like, if there's a scheme, he has to be in on it, even if it's against what he truly wants, which is right. A baby-free life.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, I mean, I guess maybe he doesn't want Kimberly to lose her shit on him. That might be the thing he gets out of it. But I don't know. It was just so, I was like, why don't I? I figured he was going to be like, turns out it is your baby. Now let's come up with a scheme of how to get the baby to you, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Amanda calls Billy into her office, annoyed that D&D is paying for Allison's treatment at Twin Oaks. She wants Billy to get the agency out of having to pay, but he says it's part of the standard employee coverage package. She wants him to fire Allison, and he explains that he can't because it's against the law. And Amanda says she likes Billy's sneaky side, but if he pulls anything else like that, she'll fry him. Peter arrives to ask Amanda if she needs help because he's heard some accounts are shaky. She insists everything is under control, but confesses she feels guilty about Bruce. On his way out, Peter says to watch out for Billy, who he thinks has designs on Amanda.
Why does he think that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that this is like, I got the sense that now we're supposed to see him as like the standard issue, a controlling, abusive partner or whatever. Allison shares her story with a support group at Twin Oaks, and a fellow patient named Terry laughs and berates her. Oh my God, this Terry person. I was like literally laughing every time he was on the screen. He laughs and berates her. They will almost certainly bone. And he was like, oh, can you believe this self-pitying crap? Which is totally recovery talk. Like, we talk a lot about self-pity and all that stuff. In recovery, but it was just so funny to me how like aggressive he was, almost like the Incredible Hulk, you know, like it felt like have you ever seen the cheesy horror movie from the 80s, Silent Night, Deadly Night?
Oh yes.
And you know when that guy is like walking around town and he like smashes those garbage cans and he's like, it's garbage day or whatever. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. We've even talked about it on this podcast before.
The acting, Terry's acting reminds me of that guy.
Oh, yeah, totally. And, you know, now's a good time to mention who Terry is played by. It's David James Elliott from the long-running show that I've never seen an episode of, JAG.
Oh my God, JAG. God, that's like, I don't think I've ever seen an episode either. That's like such old people TV.
You know what JAG is? It's the show that's on before whatever show you want to watch. So you've seen like the end of 50 episodes.
Right. Yeah, I've seen like 5 minutes of the show in total, and they're not even like strung together 5 minutes.
Their counselor here at the facility that we're about to mention is also played by Francesca P. Roberts, who is one of those very prolific character actors. Once you see her, you'll be like, wow, I've seen her in a million things. I couldn't name one to save my life. But
right, yeah. Okay, so the counselor, Marcia, assigns Allison to help Terry in the kitchen for her work detail. In the kitchen, Allison tells Terry that she recognizes him from his football career and that he's a great athlete, which just pisses him off. Billy and Susan invite Matt and Jeffrey over for dinner, and Jeffrey cuts himself while chopping vegetables directly on the counter with no cutting board. He dumps all the food in the sink and runs out for air. He also swats Matt's hand away, worried that he'll get sick, but Matt reassures him that HIV positive people are in kitchens everywhere. Allison calls Billy's apartment to get Susan. She wants Billy to come to Twin Oaks for a meeting for the people who got their friends into the program. Terry throws wet steel wool at Allison for talking on the phone instead of scrubbing pots. He tells her that in addition to being a drunk, he's sexually impulsive. Shocker. And Marcia doesn't know about it. So he's in recovery and is like super hardcore, but doesn't think that he needs to get honest about his sexual addiction. Come on. He also apologizes. Later at the meeting, Allison holds a seat for Billy, but he never shows up. She calls the apartment and gets the phone machine because Susan tells Billy not to answer while they snuggle, and she doesn't leave a message. She grabs her jacket and heads to the bar from before.
So a couple of things here. Do you think this might be one of the... Like, I think this is a really influential episode because I don't remember people constantly talking about sex addiction before this, but... Certainly after this, it became a very common thing for especially male celebrities to say they had.
I guess I don't remember people talking about sex addiction until way later than the mid-90s. I mean, I wouldn't have known about that conversation when this show was on, if it was in the social milieu. Like, I remember when David Duchovny claimed he had sex addiction or whatever, but that would have been more like 2007. Yeah. I don't know.
So very ahead of its time, Melrose Place is.
Sex addiction isn't even, it's like not been proven to be real.
No.
So it's a very shaky concept.
And then the other thing that just occurred to me now is if freaking Allison would have just said, hey, Billy, if you're there, pick up. I'm waiting for you here at the thing.
Yeah.
Like, that was one of the only things phone machines were good for, was that people could hear you if you were leaving a message, and, you know, you could screen calls and people could tell you if they were worth picking up for. Like,
right.
That use the phone machine, Allison.
Yeah, it's all very weird. She climbs back into her room later, drunk, to find Terry waiting up for her. He grabs her by the hair, throws water on her face, makes her look herself in the mirror, and throws her into bed, saying he'll stay all night to make sure she sleeps it off. In the morning, she thanks him for his help, and he says he'll keep what happened a secret if she'll commit to getting sober. He confesses that while he slept, he had to contend with his old urges, telling him to take advantage of her. But he's like, but I didn't, because you're a friend, and... you're helping me get better, too.
He probably masturbated, though.
I mean, I was like, it's just the whole thing. Like, how intense he is so hilarious, this whole episode. Matt makes Jeffrey breakfast, and the subject turns to them moving in together, which Matt has been asking for. Jeffrey needs to settle out before he settles down, though. Amanda arrives to make sure Jeffrey knows that she's heard via Susan that Jeffrey's HIV positive. Jeffrey storms out. Like, what was the point of Amanda doing that? Was she just being messy for the sake of being messy?
I mean, that's a very Amanda thing to do. Like,
oh, completely. But I just didn't really, I was like, I don't even know if there's an ulterior motive here. It just feels like she's just being Amanda.
Yeah. But I just love it. She's like, hey, heard you got the grids, but don't worry, I know I won't get it from you. Later.
It was so weird. Billy brings Allison some insurance forms, and
you missed one.
Oh. Sorry, I scrolled down. Peter interrupts Billy and Amanda in her office and brings up their former romance, plus the pregnancy once Billy leaves. Peter reminds her that they have an important dinner, which she insists he's never mentioned, while a boom microphone comes into the shot several times. She tries to say she can't make it to dinner, but he says it's not optional. Billy brings Allison some insurance forms, and Allison's pissed that he didn't come. Oh, and you know what I found out via Googling? That the guy that plays Peter and Amanda and Heather Locklear were a couple. Whoa. From like 2007 to 2011. So like way after Melrose Place.
That's weird. They met in the 90s and then waited like 14 years and then got together.
Yeah, although he was married like before her. So maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. Billy brings Allison some insurance forms, and Allison's pissed that he didn't come to the meeting, which he knows nothing about. She believes him when he says Susan never told him about the meeting, and they hug. He goes home furious with Susan, but she says she just forgot. She doesn't want to hear about Allison's alcoholism because her own mom was an alcoholic too, and she was completely neglected because of it. And Susan wants Billy to stop seeing Allison, but he says he can't, and that he'll always love Allison. Jeffrey finds Matt at the door, at the outdoor cafe where they originally met, and tells him he should spend some time alone, but he does at least hold his hand across the table, which is a lot of gay PDA for this show. Susan runs into Billy in the courtyard as she's moving her stuff out of his apartment. He apologizes for what happened and says he still cares for her, but she tells him to go to hell and leaves. Good for her. I mean, you know, I think like when we were watching Billy and Allison have their little heart to heart about the fact that he didn't know about the meeting, and you know, she was like, and he was like, you trust me, don't you? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, you know, I mean, he actually didn't know. In this situation, he's right. But just the level of like forgiveness that is extended to Billy on this show is completely bananas.
Yeah. Although I am curious where the hell Susan's going to go. She doesn't have a job yet, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. And at one point they were fighting in the apartment. So they were moving all around the apartment, and I was like watching this scene go down, and I was like, how do these two people have so much stuff already in this apartment that they've barely been in together for a minute? You know, like, yeah, I don't know.
She arrived via airplane, right? Like, she wouldn't have brought much.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, then I was like, well, it's probably mostly Billy stuff, but does Billy seem like the kind of person who would have a bunch of stuff? Like, there's, like, knickknacks everywhere and stuff.
Yeah, Allison was always the knickknacky poster person. Well, no, he had, like, dumb, like, JFK posters and shit.
Right. So, Jeffrey, blah, 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 go to hell. Okay, Terry walks Allison to her room and tries to kiss her goodnight, but she stops him short since she's worried about his sex addiction. And then Peter comes to Amanda's to invite her out for drinks and discussion, and he gets mad when she says that she has work to do. He says the only reason she has a job is that she slept with him and that she can't break up with him because nobody walks out on him. Oh. So we're definitely getting set up for like a domestic violence situation.
For sure. Well, that brings us to our annual Christmas episode, episode 15, Holiday on Ice. And I'm going to start with a little note about the episode that it took me a few times seeing this to really confirm that I was for sure seeing what I was seeing. Melrose Place is all decorated with a ton of Christmas lights, and it's completely fake. And the reason you can tell is because none of the Christmas lights are reflected in the pool.
I mean, they looked fake.
Yeah, it looked fake anyway, but I'm like, you know, but it's also bad 90s quality, but there is a way to confirm because they didn't put reflections in the pool, which I love stuff like that.
It's kind of like how those times where they like special effects in the sky above Melrose Place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminded me of that.
You know, speaking of which, I noticed a couple of times in this batch of episode that they added like when people are higher up, like at the top of stairs, you can see like hills off in the distance. So they've done even more than just the sky, which I was impressed by. I mean, it still looks totally fake, but you can kind of see a world surrounding Melrose Place now a little bit more. It still looks terrible. But anyway, Matt confronts Michael about the baby switcheroo, but Michael reminds him that if they try to take Michael Jr. away, Joe will end up in jail again. Michael heads home, with a Christmas tree, but tells Kimberly not to get too attached to Michael Jr. when she starts an impromptu photo shoot with the tree. Matt and Jeffrey bring holiday donations from the hospital to an AIDS charity, and Jeffrey is a little overwhelmed, but says he knows he won't end up sick like the people there, and I would love to know how he knows that. Jane summons Sydney to her apartment.
Oh, and when they came out of the hospital and they like walked outside, I was like, they just completely reused whatever is the front of Twin Oaks for that. It's the exact same looking staircase. It's just shot from a different angle.
Awesome.
The
outside of the hospital has looked a few different ways. Like sometimes it looks like stock footage from the early 70s. And sometimes, like when Michael got run over, it just kind of looks like they're by an office park. Like, for an imaginary hospital, they've really taken some liberties with the appearance. Peter runs into Matt in the courtyard. Nope, wait. Jane summons Sydney to her apartment to talk to their dad on the phone. She says she can't come home for Christmas, but Jane reminds her that she does have 4 days off. Their dog had puppies, which tempts her, but Sydney stands firm and says that she won't come, even after their dad apologizes for locking her up. Jane asks again after they hang up, and Sydney finally agrees for some reason. Peter runs into Matt in the courtyard at Melrose Place, and he and Joe tell Peter about the baby switcheroo. He summons Michael to his office to tell him Joe told him about the baby switcheroo and that Michael has put the whole hospital at risk. He tells Michael to give Michael Jr. back. Now. Back at the beach house, Kimberly complains that she's been given a double shift on Christmas Eve, which Michael probably arranged to get her out of the way so that he can return the baby. Jeffrey showers Matt with gifts, including a 7-day cruise to the Bahamas. Jeffrey talked to Matt's supervisor, and he has plenty of vacation time to use, so they can leave tomorrow, because that would definitely work like that. Like, somebody who works at a hospital will just tell anybody HR information like that. Matt asks how he can afford everything and says it seems like Jeffrey is running away. He's worried about Jeffrey's future, but Jeffrey says he doesn't really have one. He says if Matt can't handle his need to live in the now, then maybe they don't belong together. And this just reminded me of something I remembered from the 90s, just now reading this. Did you ever hear about people with HIV selling their life insurance policies to companies that would pay them money that they could use then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that until I had heard, one time somebody that we knew, I was like, they don't have a job. How are they always doing all this stuff? And my partner at the time was like, oh, he sold his life insurance policy because he's not going to be around much longer. I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of dark. I hadn't thought about that in forever. Michael drops Michael Jr. off at Joe's with no car seat. She summons.
He's like, I just drove over here with this baby on my
lap. Yeah, totally. I let him steer. She summons Jake the next morning to show off Michael Jr. and to let him know that nobody can know that he's there, which is completely unrealistic because everybody is going to hear that damn baby constantly crying. Obviously, anyone who's lived in apartments knows this.
Yeah, that baby cries a lot.
Jeffrey comes to the hospital to tell Matt that while he loves him, he had no business trying to be in a relationship because the only commitment that he could honestly make right now is to himself. They hug, and Jeffrey leaves for the cruise alone. Kimberly comes home from her double shift and finds no baby. Michael tells her that Joe told Peter, and he threatened to fire them, and she realizes that it was Michael who changed her schedule. She flings the patio door open and runs into the ocean.
Oh my God, this scene was so amazing.
And Michael drags her out of the water by the tits.
Like, she was barely in the water, and she just flops on her stomach and seems to start to paddle like she's swimming, but she's not getting anywhere.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, that so funny. They got to keep it where the camera can see, I guess.
Right.
While Michael showers, Kimberly calls the Carters to tell them
about the baby switcheroo. I mean, who did not see this coming?
Right?
Like, I was like, y'all better sit on that bitch 24/7. She is totally going to call the Carters.
Seriously.
Like, what the hell?
I mean, how she got their number, we'll never know. But I guess everybody was in the phone book back then. Right, wow. You had to pay to not be. Damn. Memories. I wonder how many people are listening and they're like, phone book? What?
Right.
Amanda comes to Peter's office to let him know that she'll file a lawsuit against him if he ever harasses her again. But he's just turned on by the assertiveness. So then she heads to D&D, where Billy's throwing a Christmas party. She wants him to shut it down, and he reminds her that she's due at the rehab center for a 2 p.m. meeting. Allison's doctor wants her to start mending her relationships. Allison finds Bruce's sister, Donna Teller, which is a great name, Donna Teller, in her office, who's there because Bruce died so suddenly that his sons were left with nothing and they can't afford their tuition. Amanda tells her Bruce took out substantial personal loans that can never be repaid and were written off, so she can't help. Donna wishes her Merry Christmas and leaves, like the total guilt trip. Merry Christmas. Amanda arrives at Twin Oaks and lets Allison know that while she can't fire her during her stay at what she calls Pity Me Pines, that she shouldn't try to make a career for herself at D&D. Terry overhears this and acknowledges that Allison wasn't exaggerating when she said what a nightmare Amanda is. Amanda coughs in bed while lightning strikes, and a shadowy figure appears at the bedroom door. It's Bruce! Ghost Bruce wants to know why she won't help his kids and says it's her fault that he killed himself. He makes her touch the rope burn on his neck that never heals, and she finally wakes up. This is so Shakespearean to me.
Well, it was. I felt like it was a play on the Christmas Carol.
Right. Did it get so intimate with like a wound that won't heal though? But what's the one? Oh no, that's Blood on the Hands from Macbeth. Right. Never mind. So Peter comes the next morning to pick her up for a flight, but she's sick and she doesn't want to talk to him anyway. He has a fur coat for her, a perfect present for Los Angeles.
I was, okay, yeah, I had the same thought. I was like, do people wear fur coats in LA? Like, it's literally Christmas and everybody's running around in short sleeves. Like,
yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, luxury is one thing, but diamonds are the way to go, I think. He says that they can go to Lake Tahoe together as soon as she feels better. Billy visits Allison at Twin Oaks and gives her back that weird music box from before. We talked about it in the last episode or the one before that. He tells her that he's proud of her, and she rubs his shoulder while he says, while she says that everything has become so clear for her. She laments that it was supposed to be their first Christmas together as a married couple, but he says he's not feeling Christmas that year anyway. And Terry sees them hug.
Dun, dun, dun.
Ghost Bruce comes back to critique the fur coat and takes Amanda to Christmas Past, where Memory Mandy, the kid version of her, plays with a dolly by the tree. Palmer comes in to let Mandy know that he's leaving with a woman who looks very 90s, even though it should have been 1967 or so.
I know, yeah.
excuse me. The next night, Ghost Bruce visits again to show her Christmas future, where they find her funeral with no mourners. Her husband, Peter, told the authorities that she died in a tragic skiing accident, and now he controls D&D. Amanda can't believe that she dies alone with nobody who cares about her, and Ghost Bruce explains that it's not too late for her to change her life for the better. She needs to get rid of Peter, and she needs to just turn the tables on him and destroy him before he destroys her. Pardon me. Amanda heads to Bruce's house with a gift basket to apologize to Donna Teller. She explains that Bruce's sons, who don't even get up to say hi, will be back at their schools in 2 weeks if the grants that they applied for come through. But Amanda has arranged for checks to be issued to them every semester. She says Bruce's sons don't need to know where the money came from, and Donna can say that Bruce made the arrangements, but since we can hear the boys' forks clacking on their plates the entire time, I think we can assume that they heard everything Amanda said.
Yeah, and like that one son was like giving her dirty looks, and so I assumed that they knew that she was like the evil bitch that wouldn't give them any money for school. Right. I don't know, like the whole thing was weird.
But it's just like, you know, I have to wonder, did they maybe just like get some random footage of two actors at a table, because they didn't get up and they didn't interact and they didn't talk. So I'm like, maybe they just used some stock footage trickery or something. Amanda comes back to Twin Oaks because, you know, probably for at least one episode, she's going to be a new Amanda because of what happened with Ghost Bruce, right? She apologizes to Allison and she tells her her job is safe. Later at dinner, Terry pulls Allison aside to ask if she's going back to Billy. He says he's falling in love with her, and she says that she cares about him too. And they kiss under the mistletoe. That's the episode. And, Nan, are you okay? Nan? I don't know if Nan knows that they're muted. Oh, Nan's computer says their mic isn't working. So I think I will go ahead and record an ending to this episode now in case... Oh, yep. Thumbs up from Nan. So a quick reminder that we have an Instagram now. Go follow Melrose Sheltering in Place on Instagram. And you can also find us both on TikTok. Nan is at Nanarchist and I'm at Xtofer575. Thanks for joining us for another three amazing episodes of the greatest soap opera ever. Bye-bye.